can find their trenchant essays, provocative essays at Black Agenda Report. Going to go to Mumi Abu-Jamal, the regular feature. And Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier, which isn't about the school shooting, but I guess she already had it in the can. It's about the drastic budget. And maybe she mentions the cutting back of money to mental health while they're saying this is a mental health problem exclusively. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, not necessarily reflecting others at the station, any part, any group, associates, etc. Well, I mean, I guess I should make a personal statement here. I was just talking to Carol. I've got some surgery on Monday. I don't know how blissfully oblivious I'm going to be for how many days, so I'm going to put some stuff into a package, and I'm going to go to the Intercept and try to make an hour out of the James Risen pair of interviews that are up at the Intercepted podcast, just because I think they're so brilliant. And I'll have that in hand. I'm hoping to be back in the saddle, or at least be able to craft a show other than that through the week with some of the more pertinent stuff. Going to the Intercepted about MS-13? Well, anyway, the Salvadoran gang that's being used as another wedge by Trump et al., his DOJ, Beauregard, Sessions. And also about a half hour with a scholar who's got a book out called Race and the Long War. It's about American exceptionalism. I haven't figured out how to pronounce his first name. So his last name is Singh. He's an academic out on the East Coast. And it's a very provocative thesis he has about American exceptionalism. He even goes so far as questioning some of the motives of the so-called Good War, World War II, which reminds me that I think Zinn had something late in his life where he was Bombardier's Zinn, Howard Zinn, People's History, where he was talking about what was all going on in the underpinnings of the deeper state. The cloakrooms, you know, grand area strategy, planning for Pax Americanus after World War II. So it's provocative. I already gave the disclaimer. I'm still wrestling with it myself. So that's going to fill up the hour pretty well. So I should probably get on with Mumi Abu-Jamal and... he's talking about white supremacy, too. That's part of what's involved in Professor Singh's thesis, actually, is the whole white supremacy subject matter. And what else? Well, locally, there's a threat of a strike by the Graduate Employees Union. If you know anybody, maybe you need to give some material aid to them, or maybe just some comfort and support, whatever you can do, I guess. It's an important issue. I hope our brother, sibling, I guess I should say, sibling unions are very supportive too. Maybe they'll even do a solidarity walkout. At least honor the lines, as it were. I don't know what all the strategies are, but look for that. And please go beyond the News Gazette's coverage of same. Of course, the labor hour is now over at RFU, which is available in the community and online, I think. And one of the movers and shakers in the GEO, Gus Woods, is on that. So that's a place to get an update. And I think they archive. But anyway, here's Mumi Abu-Jamal. Still needs a new trial after all these years. He's off of death row, and I think he's sort of off of slow death row, which was his non-treatment of his hepatitis C. Let's check this essay out. And then Amy Goodman's short essay, and then the interview with a woman writer about the Salvadoran gang whose matador image is being runabout. There was a fairly good front line on the same subject matter. I have not been commending front line to people's attentions lately. I've found it, particularly the Putin two-parter, as being very, very myopic and Americanly exceptional. I don't even like to say American exceptionalism. It's U.S. exceptionalism. America includes Central America and South America, and they prefer us not to use their name exclusively.
Not surprisingly, ignored the suffering of his employees' ex-wives. The only real surprise here was why the surprise. After the Roy Moore debacle of a U.S. Senate candidate's Lolita complex, as in a hankering for young girls, who can dare plead surprise? Only someone who hasn't really been looking can feign surprise. Trump's central program is to somehow return America to the 1950s when Negroes were quiet, women were submissive, and Hispanics knew their place, like Mexico, Puerto Rico. This fever dream, a Back to the Future reality show, is the focus of Trump world. To do this, you have to ignore history to build a new history in imitation of the supposed old days. Yes, it's crazy, but it ain't the only time the U.S. went crazy. Consider the war mania that resulted from 9/11. War on anybody to quell the beating heart drunk with fear. Iraq, check. Afghanistan, double check. War to salve the worried American soul. In Trump world, blacks don't count. Hispanics don't count. Arabs don't count. Women don't count either. Yes, even white women. It's time for the good old boys. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
The Trump budget's crushing cruelty. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. On Monday, President Donald Trump released his proposed budget for 2019. On the heels of his only legislative accomplishment to date, the massive tax cut that favors the wealthiest individuals and corporations, Trump's budget would slash or completely eliminate core anti-poverty programs that form the heart of the U.S. social safety net, from childhood nutrition to care for the elderly and job training. It blatantly violates one of his key campaign promises to leave untouched Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. The Trump budget is a document of towering immorality, a wish list of extreme right-wing cuts to federal spending that would destroy a century of progressive legislative achievements. Congress will be in recess for the next week, and elected representatives who support Trump's cruel agenda should expect a wave of opposition as people organize resistance from coast to coast.
This budget is the budget of the Koch brothers. It is the budget of the billionaire class, and the American people understand it.
That's Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders railing against Charles and David Koch, the two billionaire industrialist brothers who have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into U.S. elections in order to promote their far-right agenda. Sanders continued,
"This is a budget which will make it harder for our children to get a decent education, harder for working families to get the health care they desperately need, harder to protect the air that we breathe and the water we drink, and harder for the elderly to live out their retirement years with dignity and respect. This is not a budget, as candidate Donald Trump talked about, that takes on the political establishment. This is a budget of the political establishment. This is the Robin Hood principle in reverse. It is a budget that takes from the poor and gives to the very wealthy."
Seattle Congressmember Pramila Jayapal calls it
the three strikes, you're out budget.
This is Seattle Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, vice-ranking member of the House Budget Committee and vice chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
Strike one was to actually transfer $1.3 trillion in wealth from working people and the poor to the wealthiest through the GOP tax scam. And to their credit, they are finally saying in this budget that actually those GOP tax cuts don't pay for themselves because they're projecting these enormous deficits as a result of the tax cuts. Strike two is that they're essentially going to balloon the deficit. And as you said, $7 trillion over 10 years, $1 trillion next year alone. And strike three is cutting every program that allows people to live with any shred of dignity, any shred of hope, any shred of opportunity.
The federal budget is a massive document representing $4.4 trillion of spending for just one year. Republicans have long claimed cutting the budget and eliminating budget deficits as their raison d'etre. Now, with both houses of Congress and the White House under Republican control, they have apparently abandoned their principles. A spending bill passed with bipartisan support February 9th in order to avoid a government shutdown increased military spending, a Trump priority, as well as spending in domestic programs, which the Democrats wanted. It also raised federal borrowing limits and spending caps. But that spending deal doesn't compel the government to spend funds as agreed to. The devil is in the details, as the saying goes, and those details get hammered out in congressional appropriations and other large bills like the upcoming farm bill.
And just as an example, let's just look at SNAP. This is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Again, Washington Congressmember Jayapal speaking on Democracy Now.
They are proposing a $213 billion cut to SNAP. They're proposing that people have to work in order to get these benefits. And remember that three quarters of all the SNAP recipients are the elderly, the disabled, and families with children. And the average per person per meal benefit that people get on SNAP is $1.40.
Similar changes are proposed that would cut funding to Medicaid, Social Security Disability Insurance, known as SSDI, and housing assistance, as well as force onerous work requirements on recipients when a number of them are often unable to work. Many Beltway observers concede that the Trump budget has almost no chance of being passed. Of course, these are the same people who said Trump had no chance of being elected. But the budget relays a vision for the country held by the president and the Republican Party. This budget signals a dark, heartless, and cruel future, exacerbating poverty, inequality, and suffering. It's a budget that the people of the United States cannot afford. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I'll do some community announcements. The Red Herring's 50th birthday party. Starting at 4:30 this evening, going to 10:30. Some of the musical entertainment offerings are Paul Kottheimer, The Merry Travelers, Duclaw, Revelator. And Revelator features Kenna May, her latest group, doing some of her older tunes with a combo and some newer tunes too. It says many others to be announced. Storytellers include founding participants Bill Taylor, who also helped found WEFT here, and Vern Fine, who was my TA in rhetoric, advanced rhetoric, or whatever it was called, introductory rhetoric. American Revolutionary Thought, wrote an essay on the Wobblies, if I recall. Oh, there is a little rundown. And they have a week-long events at the Red Herring, too. I was going to say, I think you can park on the south part of the Krannert Underground parking. If they have a marquee event, it gets kind of packed in there, but on the other end of things, I don't know if I think it's open parking, so it's only a block and a half to the Red Herring. Kenna May and the Revelators are holding forth. Well, it says Kenna May Rice, so maybe she's sitting in with some of these other bands. Kilbourne Alley, the Blue Tone Drivers, Blues Deacons, Joe Aslin. Hope he plays a lot of harp, though he's a kick-ass guitar player. This is a 4 p.m. February 25th, so a little further down the line, but mark your calendars. And that is a benefit for WEFT and co-benefiting the Daily Bread Soup Kitchen downtown, where they give away packed lunches, and I think they have a breakfast. I'm not sure. I'm running out of time here, so it's time to start it up. And we're going to start with the MS-13 document. And this is, again, from Jeremy Scahill's great new podcast. They're up to approaching 50 editions. If you haven't checked it out, the archive is brilliant. I'm not playing any of the satirical four-piece because I want to get this half hour with Professor Singh on following this interview with Intercept journalist who's focused on the Salvadoran street gang that's being used, it seems to me.
And rampaging through the country, killing ordinary Americans.
As you know, the bloodthirsty cartel known as MS-13 has infiltrated our schools, threatening innocent children. MS-13 are the equivalent in their meanness to Al-Qaeda.
Listening to Trump, one would come away with the impression that this gang is like a mashup of Al-Qaeda and a paramilitary force that has operated with impunity and must be stopped. Now, MS-13 is definitely a violent, murderous gang. Over a two-year period, the group killed some 25 people in Long Island, New York. But what's often left out of this recent discussion about MS-13 is how most of its victims are immigrants themselves. And this is the point. Trump's rhetoric often employs wild exaggerations and factual inaccuracies. MS-13 was founded in Los Angeles in the 1980s, and it accounts for less than an estimated 1% of U.S. gang membership. When U.S. federal agents conducted a series of raids against MS-13 in 2015 and 2016, most of the people arrested were found to be U.S. citizens. So the dots that Trump wants people to connect are in fact not there. But of course, Trump's talk of MS-13 is not really about that gang. It's a major dog whistle aimed at supporting the administration's racist targeting of undocumented and also documented immigrants in the United States. My colleague Alice Sperry has an in-depth feature article up at The Intercept about Trump, MS-13, and how Trump's war on gangs has given the green light for federal agents to target high school students for deportation. Alice's article is called From School Suspension to Immigration Detention, and she tells the story of how increased police presence in schools has merged with the aggressive federal deportation program under Trump. Kids who end up in trouble for reasons that would traditionally be handled within the school are now being criminally charged, and some have actually been snatched from their homes by ICE agents and sent into deportation proceedings. Alice has spent time on the ground in Long Island researching this story. That's one of MS-13's largest bases of operation, and Alice joins me now. Welcome back to Intercepted.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start just big picture here. Explain what MS-13 is.
Right. We've heard a lot about the MS-13 in the last several months, and all of a sudden it seems like this is the focus of this administration. Trump suddenly learned about this gang, and suddenly everything he's doing is somewhat related to it. The MS-13, or Mara Salvatrucha, is a gang that is actually not from Central America, as many believe. It's a gang that originally started in Los Angeles in the 1980s, and it was mostly made up of the kids of immigrants at the time, and refugees, really, people that were fleeing the civil war in El Salvador at the time. Ironically, or tragically, if you will, this gang has become a problem in Central America after these families were deported and returned to El Salvador and Central America after the wars were over. The MS-13 is one of several gangs. Its main rivals are the Barrio 18 in El Salvador. And some of these people have returned to the United States, you know, through immigration in various ways. But the gang here is actually pretty loosely related to the gang back in El Salvador. I mean, they're really independent groups for the most part. What the administration is saying is that the gang is explicitly trying to take advantage of our immigration loopholes, as the president calls them, to bring gangsters through the border through the unaccompanied minor program and settle them into communities like Long Island, like Maryland, and other places that have large Salvadoran communities. But really, when you look at the history, this is as American a gang as it gets.
First of all, it seems pretty clear that this is a recent discovery by Donald Trump.
Absolutely. One of our colleagues did a story where he looked at all of Trump's speeches during the campaign, and he never once mentioned this gang at all. He was really obsessed with Chicago at that point.
Since President Obama became president, almost 5,000 killings in Chicago.
In Chicago, which has the toughest gun laws in the United States, probably you could say by far, they have more gun violence than any other city.
In Chicago, 3,664 people have been shot since January 1st of this year. Can you believe that? That's worse than the places you read about and see in the Middle East. These are war zones.
it was all dog whistling about black people committing crimes and the black people are the violent ones. And now this is sort of, it's more than dog whistling, but it's basically like immigrants are going to murder you and rape you.
Absolutely. And it's really, I mean, the MS-13 tragedy is that it's really come at an opportune time for this administration. It has given them an excuse to do what they wanted to do, which is mass deport people, which is racially profile Latinos and particularly Latino youth and detain them first, right? Because they have to fill those, all these immigration centers and all these privately run detention centers they have and then deport them. So it's of course a real gang and it's a brutal and extremely violent one, but it has also provided an excuse and an opportunity for this administration to really implement pretty fascist-friendly immigration policies.
Well, you know, Donald Trump at his State of the Union address invited families whose loved ones were killed reportedly by MS-13.
These two precious girls were brutally murdered while walking together in their hometown. Six members of the savage MS-13 gang have been charged with Kayla and Nisa's murders.
One of the things that you point out in your excellent article that I hope everyone reads is that most of the victims of MS-13 are not white Americans.
Right.
They are.
Well, most of the victims are immigrants, like most of the perpetrators, and many of them did come in as unaccompanied minors. Many of them are undocumented.
The victims, you mean?
The victims and the perpetrators. So it really, it's, you know, as often is the case with gang violence, the victims and the perpetrators very much share the same background. What happened in Long Island is that there was actually an escalation in violence for a number of years, and people there say that police and authorities didn't really take it seriously until 2016 when two girls who happened to be U.S. citizens and the daughters of U.S. citizens, they weren't white, but they were American families that really felt, they felt better able to go to police. They were less scared to go to police and demand justice for their daughters. And these two girls, of course, were brutally murdered. The story is absolutely horrifying. And that's what really put Long Island and the Long Island gang violence problem on the map for the rest of the country. But it didn't start there. There were kids that had gone missing months before that. And in fact, when police finally started investigating these two murders, they started finding all these other bodies, mostly immigrant kids that had gone missing for months and that nobody had really bothered to look for. One of the things that I'm hearing over and over again, and I think that's what's really interesting, it tells you how much of an American story this is as opposed to this transnational immigrant one that the administration is trying to portray, is the fact that this violence is happening the same way that violence happens in other American communities, because schools are underfunded, because kids don't have places to hang out at, because there's massive poverty because of, you know, the same issues we see in suburban communities all over the country.
Your article centers around the story of one teenager in Long Island. You call him Dennis. You've changed his name for his own protection, who is right now in jeopardy of being deported. Explain his story.
Dennis arrived in Long Island just over 2 years ago as an unaccompanied minor, which means he crossed the border without a parent or a legal guardian. And he was one of more than 8,000 kids who crossed the border alone and resettled in Long Island, which is one of the largest communities where unaccompanied minors were resettled. He had left El Salvador because of fear of gangs there. He, you know, a gang there had tried to recruit him. A few kids were killed in his neighborhood, and he just fled to join his mother, who already lived in Long Island. And then when he arrived, as many unaccompanied minors do, he filed for immigration, which is a process that's pretty lengthy. And so he was really in legal limbo. He was awaiting for his legal status to be approved. Meanwhile, he attended school. He went to Hempstead High School. He was doing well. One day, he says he was attacked by a group of kids that he didn't know that called him Chavala, which is this gang slang word for enemies of the MS-13. He said he defended himself, and that resulted in a school suspension. Now, in any other situation, that would have just ended there with a school suspension. But we are seeing two things happening here. First of all, because of the growing partnership between local law enforcement and schools, there are police officers that are now stationed in schools across the country, including Long Island. And so often when something like that happens, that normally would just be a disciplinary issue, a criminal charge is triggered. And that's what happened in this case. Dennis got an assault charge on his previously clean record. Secondly, because he's undocumented, while awaiting his immigration status to be legalized, he had ICE agents show up at his door. Though that didn't happen right away. That happened months after his suspension. So he thought he was fine. He thought he was doing well. He was taking remedial classes. He was, you know, kind of keeping a low profile and trying not to get in trouble. And then one day, out of nowhere, ICE showed up at his door. They let themselves in. And I say that because they told the mother, we have to come in. They didn't ask, can we come in? And this is an important point because ICE maintains that their officers don't just walk into a place. They need a warrant or they need a consent of the person.
Did they have any warrant?
They didn't have a warrant. And what, according to what Mato tells me, they didn't ask to be let in. They just said, we have to come in. They took Dennis with them. They told the mom they would bring him back. They didn't bring him back. She called the police. The police told her, it's ICE. We can't do anything about it. And then a day later, Dennis called her from LaGuardia Airport while he was on his way to California. And he was sent to YOLO Detention Center in Northern California, which is a center for unaccompanied minors. Usually that's where kids across the border are sent while the government tries to figure out their situation. But increasingly, a lot of kids that have lived in the U.S. for months or years and suddenly are accused of gang affiliation are being picked up by ICE and sent there.
So they were going to deport this teenager to...
Before somebody is deported, they will be sent to a detention center while an immigration judge reviews their case. While that happened, his lawyers, of course, got involved. And, you know, his mother, who's an undocumented worker in a restaurant, she's definitely, like, not wealthy by any means. She's paid thousands of dollars to an immigration attorney.
Yeah, you said $5,000.
$5,000, yeah. After having paid $6,000 to get Dennis smuggled across the border by a coyote, right? So the financial burden on these families is also massive.
Where is he now?
He was eventually sent back to New York after 2 months to a different detention center, a lower security detention center outside of New York City. When I met him, he was still living there. And then just recently, he was released and was able to return to Long Island. But his removal proceedings stand. So what happens is when detention centers release somebody because they don't have enough evidence, that doesn't mean that deportation risk goes away. While you're undocumented, you're going to be at risk of deportation. And so he basically lives, you know, with the expectation that ICE could come knocking on his door at any time.
In your investigation, your reporting, you've discovered this is hardly a one-off thing or sort of the exception to how these cases are handled. Talk about Operation Matador, which is ostensibly a program to target gang members, even if they don't have a criminal history. Like, that's the official explanation of it. How does it work?
Right. It's a partnership between local and federal law enforcement. And we're seeing that happening across the country right now, where you have local police departments, particularly in places that don't have sanctuary policies, work very closely with ICE and federal agents. And Operation Matador essentially gives ICE more leeway because, you know, being a gang member by itself is not a crime. But what they're doing is targeting all those people that are not being charged for a crime and just are accused of gang affiliation, and they target those for removal. So the way ICE presents it is, you know, this is a way for them to arrest somebody and deport them before they commit crimes. And what's interesting about this is that Congress has been trying to pass legislation that would essentially make that the law for everybody, including immigrants with legal papers. So a week after Trump announced that he would end DACA, Congress passed a bill that would essentially make any gang affiliation, any immigrant, cause for removal, which is obviously a much looser criteria than what we have now, which is, you know, criminal conviction is required. That hasn't passed the Senate yet. It's unclear whether it will, but it kind of gives you a sense of how sweeping and broad this administration crackdown is.
You talk about how sometimes kids who don't speak English are put in a position where they are led to believe that they need to sign paperwork that they don't actually understand.
Yes, some of the tactics used by ICE, and not only ICE, local police as well, are really quite appalling. I mean, kids, again, as you mentioned, that don't speak English are made to sign away access to confidential information or confidential records. Kids are threatened with deportation in order to collaborate with authorities' investigations. Sometimes there are kids that collaborate with authorities' investigations, you know, provide them information about gangs, and then suddenly have ICE turn on them and deport them after having contributed to investigations.
And calling this thing, you know, Operation Matador, I mean, it's
disgusting.
And yet it's not at all surprising. I mean, I read your story, and as I'm reading your story, I see that Jeff Sessions is giving this speech in front of all of these sheriffs and talking about the Anglo heritage of the sheriffs.
So it's an honor for me to be with you. This is association is one of the biggest law enforcement groups in America, more than 20,075 years of history here.
He wasn't like paraphrasing some, you know, Supreme Court justice of old. He was owning that idea right now, and he knew exactly what he was saying when he was invoking the idea of the Anglo tradition of sheriffs.
Absolutely, and they're not going to any lengths to kind of like hide the racial bias that's
right. It's like the white sheriff
doing, yeah,
taking him down in Operation Matador.
Absolutely, and you know what's interesting is one of the fascinating things about this story is that the level of discourse in this administration has been pretty appallingly low across the board. But around the MS-13 question in particular, you've had ICE acting director Thomas Oman boasting, "My gang is bigger than theirs." That's the level of discourse we're seeing right now. You have Trump call these kids animals.
I was reading one of these animals was caught. And explaining they like to knife them and cut them and let them die slowly because that way it's more painful and they enjoy watching that much more. These are animals.
There's really like no effort at all to sort of disguise the racism.
And we always, when we talk about this, we always then have to go back to how did he talk about a mob of white supremacists who murdered someone, who gang beat an African-American guy in a parking garage
of the police department, and he was left there almost to die, but for bystanders who intervened. I mean, the politics of racism right now are so, it's so overt what Trump and his attorney general are doing that I can't see how anyone could interpret it any other way.
And I think it's strategic. I think he knows that there are people that want to hear that, and that's why he keeps doing it. And actually, something that didn't make it into the story, but that I think is notable, when Trump went to Long Island in July to give one of his speeches about MS-13, he was talking to a Suffolk County Police Department audience, and he basically told officers that they should feel free to rough up suspects when they arrest them, that they shouldn't be too concerned about their well-being.
I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
And the audience, which was made of police officers, cheered and clapped. And that just gives you an idea of the violence and racism that this administration is promoting.
You talked to Walter Barrientos, who is with the group Make the Road New York, and he's the coordinator for Long Island. They work really closely with families that end up in this situation. And I just want to share with our listeners some of the comments that he gave to you. He said, in essence, what they're doing is what they did post 9/11 with Muslim men. We just don't have a Guantanamo. What we have is all these immigration detention centers they're sending young people to.
Parallel with Guantanamo is really striking and really important. There's something else that's mentioned in the story that's this really widespread use of gang databases that are picking up all across the country. There are these massive databases with thousands of names on them and thousands of mistakes. You know, there's a California database that lists 42 babies as active gang members. And ICE uses these databases, and people don't know when they're inserted onto these databases, and they don't have any means to fight back, which is very similar to what happened with the no-fly list and other Muslim surveillance lists in the last decade or so.
Alice Sperry, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
Alice Sperry is a reporter for The Intercept. Her latest article is From School Suspension to Immigration Detention.
And Sperry's with a E Latin, an I, not a Y, and one R. Great thing. I was just enough time, I think, to put on the next segment. But I did want to mention Knights of Kabiri are doing a short walk-on in the lobby of the Krannert tonight at 6:40. I mentioned in the neighborhood there's the Red Herring 50th birthday bash. Knights of Kabiri are playing Iron Post, their usual haunt, usually monthly or so, but it's been a while. Tomorrow night at 7, they're a wonderfully eclectic group, sort of based out of the Community Center for the Arts. I heard on a chat show that the shooter in Florida trained paramilitary style with a group called the Republic of Florida, and I haven't heard it anywhere else, so I'll be searching for that. Maybe it was a fake story to make it, I don't know, but I'm looking for that, and I haven't heard it on the public radio coverage, so maybe I missed it. Here's Jeremy again, and we're going to go right to it.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions gave a speech in front of the National Sheriff's Association in Washington, D.C. on Monday. And in his speech, Sessions said this.
Since our founding, the independently elected sheriff has been the people's protector. Who keeps law enforcement close to and accountable to people through the elected process.
Now, all of that was in Jeff Sessions' prepared remarks. But then the attorney general followed up with this statement that was not in the prepared remarks released by the Justice Department.
The office of sheriff is a critical part of the Anglo-American heritage of law enforcement. We must never erode this historic office.
Yes, I know there's a legalistic and historical backstory to the use of the term Anglo when talking about sheriffs. You know what? There's also a legalistic and historic backstory to Black people being banned from voting or being counted as 3/5 of a person. Jeff Sessions knew what he was doing. Maybe someone else could be cut some slack or ask for clarification if they said that. But we're talking about a man in Jeff Sessions whose own colleagues said that he used the N-word. And that he would make jokes about how he was going to join the Ku Klux Klan. There is nothing in Jeff Sessions' history that would allow us to see what he did in that speech to the sheriffs as anything but a wink-wink to let the racists know he's still their man. Just like Trump saying that there are good people on both sides, just like how Trump and his acolytes constantly talk about violence in Chicago as a substitute for the racist perspective they only want thinly veiled these days. There's no doubt that the way that Trump talks and tweets, the people he's chosen to surround himself with, the policies he's announced or implemented, that this is a dangerous administration. But also there's a risk in combining horrible things Trump does with horrible things that the U.S. has done for a very long time and then acting like it's all Trump. It's a complicated conversation to have, but it's one that we should be having. It means exploring the historical roots of white supremacy in the United States, the way American wars are constantly put through a laundering process to make them seem noble and brave, the way real American has been defined and continues to be defined in our society. For 8 years, we had the first black president in U.S. history, and now we have a reality TV host who spends a great deal of time tweeting and watching TV. So what is unique to Trump, and what is embedded in the politics of empire in the U.S.? Our next guest has written an excellent new book that takes on a lot of these questions. Nikhil Singh is a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University. His latest book is Race and America's Longest War. Nikhil Singh, welcome to Intercepted.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start off by talking about one of the big themes in your latest book, the link between war making and what you call race making. Explain that.
You know, I start the book with an epigraph from one of my favorite thinkers who's not that well known, a civil rights activist named Jack O'Dell. And he said that the great through lines of American history run from the slave plantation to the ghetto and the frontier to the Pentagon. So he's really thinking about frontier war making as a kind of formative national experience and then an internal security project that's focused on a kind of anti-insurrectionary project aimed at slave revolts, essentially, but against a population that is seen as potentially threatening, that's internal to the republic. Both of those are projects that are defined in terms of state violence and war making that are fundamentally about alien populations, one on the border, one in the interior. And so thinking of those as through lines, thinking of those as kind of origin stories for the formation of the United States that have a kind of a long durée is something that I'm interested in and I'm kind of tracing in various ways throughout the book.
What do you mean by the phrase race making?
Race making, I mean the creation of populations, groups, whose alienage or whose difference becomes understood as constitutive of a relationship between them and another group. By calling it race making, I'm trying to highlight the fabrication of racial difference, to not see it as something that is somehow inherent out there in the world, but something that has to be produced by constituting divisions among people, often people who actually live together in the same social space. It's something that happens through the passage of laws, the restriction of movement, the allocation of resources, but in a really fundamental way, it happens through the distributions of violence. And that's really what I'm arguing in the book.
You write, the common sense view that overt, racially targeted, state-sanctioned violence is now unacceptable and a social problem leads to assessments that deem such violence, for example, police shootings of unarmed black men and women, as arising from justified fear, accident, or individual error, rather than a structured and structuring public mechanism and investment.
I'm thinking about how we're addressing a situation where we now have an increasing consciousness, partly due to movements around Black Lives Matter, that there's a widespread phenomenon of police killing of civilians, often unarmed civilians, and that it's disproportionately African Americans who are the victims of this violence, although not just African Americans, obviously. And there's, if you really look at numbers for Native American populations, you find those are disproportionate as well. So in the United States now, though, this is a little tough to parse because of Trump, but we tend to operate within an understanding of publicly sanctioned racism as something that's been receding. It's normatively unacceptable.
We had a black president.
We had a black president. We believe in inclusion. We believe in tolerance. And above all, we believe that our justice system operates fairly, which obviously extends to the police. So how do you square these two stories? How do you square the excessive force and violence of the police on aggregate, the racial disproportionality of that story, with the kind of public story that wants to tell us that we are a constantly improving society organized around the rule of law, justice, and inclusion? You square that story by essentially saying these are events that happen in error, they happen by accident, they happen because a policeman was afraid, justifiably so, and that's when the narrative starts to creep into something else, and you start to see how the sort of demonology of the black criminal or the dangerous subject kind of comes into the defense or the rationalization, right? What gets rationalized away as something that has no real systemic reason, right, has no structural reason, sort of begins to be made visible as something that actually is structured, right? It is structured into our understanding of criminality. Race, that is structured into our understanding or structures our understanding of the criminal, of the threatening, of the other in a way that is part and parcel of why there is this level of violence.
What do you make of the discussion about gay men and women serving in the United States military and the question of whether the military is going to allow for government-funded gender assignment surgery? What's your view of that? Because I sort of look at it and I sort of think, well, is it a good thing that there's this idea that we have a rainbow-colored military that's going to be slaughtering people across the world?
Yeah, it's something I think about a lot, and it's something I think about a lot in the book, which is that the military and the national security state, especially since, say, World War II, has been this kind of engine of inclusion. It has been at the forefront. I mean, it was at the forefront of racial integration, of course, under social pressure. It didn't just happen automatically. And now we see the extension of that into questions around women in combat or gays and lesbians or trans people in the military and the various ways the military is going to continue to be or not, because it's still contested, an agent of diversification. This is a tricky thing for us to work through because now that story of diversification and inclusion is enlisted in the project of empire. The project of empire clearly once had a very naked kind of racist face. You know, it was about the white man's burden. It was about benighted peoples. It was about, you know, the inferior lesser breeds and so forth in the kind of language of the, say, the British Empire or the American Empire before World War II. But after World War II, you really see how this notion of a kind of racially inclusive or multicultural imperial machine begins to develop. And I'll never forget this moment early in the Iraq War watching a Frontline episode. It was almost like one of those episodes from an American war movie where you see the kind of multicultural platoon out on patrol. It's like a Latino guy, an African-American guy, a white guy. And there are some Iraqis in handcuffs by the side of the road.
That child don't need to be here.
Know what school is?
Okay, school. That's what he need to be doing, not following you.
We filmed these GIs after they caught a group of Iraqis stealing wood.
These three guys were interrogating them, and then all of a sudden they say, "Well, you know, because you did this, we're gonna have to exact a kind of punishment."
We try to stop them from looting. They don't understand, so we'll take their car and we'll crush it. United States Army tankers, hool.
And they basically take their armored vehicle and like crush these guys' car.
That's what you get when you loot.
Later, the car's owner told us, "I'm a taxi driver. The car was my livelihood."
It's this kind of moment of sort of, you know, they don't kill them, but they steal their livelihood. They enact collective punishment, all in the sort of image of their own righteousness. These guys are in their own country. Their country is under occupation. They're trying to eke out a living. And here they are, like, facing retribution from this military machine with a multicultural face. And, you know, it's really kind of become an alibi for the empire, which still operates in its other face with the notion that it is policing and disciplining an inferior people. So even if the multicultural and inclusive face has sort of emerged as a kind of form of justification or legitimation for the American military, there is still always this other side that constructs the enemy as somehow benighted, inferior, congenitally sort of constituted as a threatening population. And that is part of the kind of underside, the sort of history of race making, to go back to the earlier point, I want to sort of foreground as a kind of insistent part of the rationale and logic of how the United States fights in the world.
The way that you talk about the language that's used in official American history to talk about war, American wars. I think it'd be interesting to kind of give some examples of how various U.S. wars have been described and talked about and sort of what is drilled into the heads of kids in this country when it comes to war.
The language of war is ubiquitous, right? We've had wars on drugs, wars on poverty, wars on crime, Cold War that lasted for 40 years, a war on terror that now we're told is going to last for another 40 years. You know, so the language of war is ubiquitous. But on the other hand, the United States hasn't declared a war anywhere in the world, really, like formally, since World War II. So there have been police actions. There have been various kinds of military authorizations.
Global contingency operations,
right,
was Obama's
right.
favorite term.
Exactly, yeah. So these sort of euphemisms for something that is not war, even though the popular discourse is all about war. And then sort of think about the kind of earlier history, a continuous history of fighting Indian wars that were not understood or recognized as wars. They were really, again, seen as contingency operations. They were seen as the operations of kind of quasi-authorized settlers. You know, they were clearing operations. They were really kind of an ongoing counterinsurgency project.
Well, and one of the right. most murderous ethnic cleansing campaigns. That is what happened here.
That is what happened here.
People from elsewhere got off their boats onto the shores and almost instantly started a mass extermination ethnic cleansing campaign of anyone that wasn't a European quote-unquote settler.
Exactly. In the context of at least initially having to confront indigenous people as a real counterforce, having temporary agreements that were then constantly broken. And once the balance of forces shifted, any acts of violence by Indians in defense of their land or in defense of their kind of customary rights was increasingly described as crime. So you have the kind of translation of sort of a language of co-equal combatants who have certain kinds of rights into a kind of asymmetrical language in which one party has the right of war and the other party is essentially seen as the party of a sort of asocial violence that needs to be disciplined, exterminated, sequestered, what have you. And so there's a reason, you know, why that history becomes so prominent again in the War on Terror, because it's almost the same kind of language. So in a strange kind of way, we've inflated the language of war, and then we've sort of hidden the idea that war is our modus operandi in the world.
And in this country, there's a media culture that dictates that you have to accept two primary factors in order to talk in a reasonable or responsible way about war. The one hand, you have that the U.S. motive is always based on some benign interest, that it's a humanitarian intervention, or it's to stop a despot or a dictator from threatening world stability, or it's that a particular country is pursuing a weapons of mass destruction program. And then the other factor that I've noticed that needs to be present is you have to agree, if it's not already natural to you, to a self-induced amnesia about how we ended up where we are, like in Syria today, in Iraq today, in Iran, in Somalia, all these countries, Pakistan, around the world, that the United States has played an active role in creating the conditions we see today. It's like you erase all of that and only talk about the narrow question that officials in the U.S. pose. Is it right or wrong to try to stop country X from pursuing weapons of mass destruction?
Absolutely. I mean, you're sort of pointing to two things. Wars are defensive. American wars are defensive. And they're in the general interest, right? So they're not motivated by a particular American desire for power, for resources. They're not connected to any sort of past history of involvement or engagement that may have produced enmities or conflicts or destabilization. They're always about creating security and creating the rule of law. So the acts of destabilization that have gone into producing the conditions of insecurity that then are sort of understood to be the motivation for the intervention are completely erased. And then the continued destabilization that is constituted by the intervention becomes the kind of stuff of like debate and sort of hand-wringing, you know, until the next time that an intervention is planned and demanded.
In your study, have you ever come across a U.S. war that you believe was actually defensive in nature?
I would actually have to say no. Even World War II was in many ways built upon threat inflation. It was built upon arguments that were later proved to be false about the ways in which the United States was actually threatened. And when you think about the rationale for World War II, when Roosevelt says we can't be an island in a sea of tyranny in the world, essentially, I mean, the thinking that's going into the intervention in World War II is that we're going to become the world ordering power after this war, and that our security is now going to be bound up with being involved in every part of the world. And I think it's Dean Acheson who says to Truman a few years later, there is no concept of security that is local anymore for the United States. That's a new thing, right? That's a new idea. But that is an idea that is not actually about sort of a national defense. It's actually about something else.
And also, I mean, it's such an incendiary topic to raise in this country. When you go to almost any public event, whether it's a graduation at a high school or a middle school, a sporting event, someone is going to invoke the heroic nature of the World War II record of the United States. And it happens Republicans, Democrats, across the board, everywhere. It's like our society is dripping in it. And as I read your book, I was sort of thinking it's such a great pushback to this notion that being born an American means you are born into the greatest nation that's ever lived, the country that saves the world. I mean, it really is like a non-starter, if you disagree with that, in the mainstream of American discourse.
To any way challenge the notion that the U.S. is a benign world-ordering power is to break from a kind of ideological sort of monolith. I mean, it's not even just a consensus. It's kind of it's the equivalent of kind of what we used to condemn as, you know, Soviet ideology, right? It's a kind of axiomatic. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, in this book and in some of my previous work, I really go back to the Black radical tradition in thinking about World War II in particular. And I use this quote from Langston Hughes, where he talks about, we hate Hitler as much as anybody, but we also want to defeat what he calls our native fascisms. And for African Americans, you know, that notion that World War II would require a double victory, a victory against fascism abroad and also against racism at home, became a very sharp critique, right? It was a refusal to prioritize something like kind of national security citizenship at the expense of the fight for justice at home, for one thing. And it was also a refusal of the idea that the United States was somehow, again, like a coherent sort of moral entity, as opposed to actually a deeply divided imperial society internal to itself, one riven by these kinds of histories of racial violence and sequester and separation and dispossession that actually were not distinct historically or conceptually from the kinds of acts that the Nazis themselves were engaged in. And in fact, National Socialists throughout the 1930s are reading about American Jim Crow law to like figure out how to write the Nuremberg laws. I mean, they see the United States as an example. They're talking about Eastern European Slavs as the equivalent of Redskins. There's a way in which, in the history of kind of racialized colonialism in the world, the United States has always been a major player. And so the idea that that history is suddenly wiped away by the fact that the United States fought against fascism in World War II is really a kind of a laundering of a much longer history. How do we square these things? This is not about saying that the United States is the source of all the world's evil or anything like that, or even that the world isn't a complicated and dangerous place in which you might actually have to think about the use of force. I mean, we could have that conversation, right, Jeremy? I mean, we could have, if we were going to have a serious conversation about how to think ethically about American power in the world.
This is part of the point I'm getting at. We can have that conversation about World War II. If
right,
you don't
exactly.
Start the history of World War II at 39, is there a such entity as Al-Qaeda that does want to kill Americans, Westerners, et cetera? Yeah, there is. I would love to have the conversation about how do we take away the motive or the justifications that these people use to their own base to justify their acts of violence. But it requires a real reckoning with American history. And that's what's not allowed.
Well, that was the amazing thing after 9/11. And it's hard to believe sometimes that 9/11 is like 17 years ago. It's just like created like a total miasma, right?
Well, and think of how many young people grew up. 9/11 is their entire reality. That's their entire frame of what's going on in the world is shaped by 9/11 and nonstop war.
That's right. And remember, the one thing that was disallowed right from the beginning of 9/11, you could not make an argument that there was motive. You could not make an argument that the people who committed that act might have had some even kernel of rational grievance that motivated it. It could only be the act of what became called terror.
If you look at the targets that were chosen, I mean, the Pentagon, clearly a military target, and then you hit the World Trade Center, right in the heart of financial power in the United States. Now, it's dangerous to even go down this line of talking about it, but I think the point that you're making is we have to remove any sense that people who are the others are motivated by a set of their own grievances that we may have played a role in creating. Rather, we can only look at it for the crime that was committed. Civilians were killed. End of story.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And the only answer that we can engage in response to that is our own kind of traumatizing violence. Right. So 9/11 was a kind of traumatizing violence for Americans, to be sure. And that was it by design. But the response to that can only be a kind of traumatizing violence, you know, and as opposed to some approach that might actually be reparative. And of course, what we have done now for the last 17 years is to commit a kind of traumatizing violence all over the world and to, if anything, strengthen the very possibility of long-range terrorist networks with motive and grievance that we were ostensibly setting out to eliminate. So on its face, it's a failure, right? In its own terms, it's a failure. But we're left with a situation where we're asked to basically believe that the only response now is to continue down the same road, right? Not to actually try to pull back and think about what it might mean to think differently about the kinds of relationships we're in with people in different parts of the world.
On the issue of Obama and how he talked about the killing of civilians, I'm sure you recall when Obama finally publicly came out and expressed some sense of regret over the killing of people in drone strikes. And it was when white Westerners, including an American citizen, were killed in strikes that Obama said were mistakes. But the overall way that Obama and his team talked about the issue of civilians being killed was always one of moral superiority. We don't intend to kill civilians. When we bomb a hospital, we didn't mean to do that. When we bomb a wedding party, we didn't mean to do that. See, that's the difference between us and Al-Qaeda. We didn't mean to do it, and they do mean to do it.
Right.
Which, by the way, that's bullshit. The United States has intentionally killed civilians, and they've said, okay, a terrorist is in this building. We want him dead. There happen to be 30 other people in there. Boom, they die today. That's cold, crass warmongering right there, and it's war crimes. But Obama really spent a lot of his moral capital with the base trying to convince people that the benign nature of American war making makes us morally superior to those who fly planes into buildings or shell a school.
Definitely. You know, and I think this is an old debate, again, even going back to like the Vietnam War and the sort of origins of American counterinsurgency, you know, the idea that we act with a minimum of violence. We, through our very careful, deliberative, kind of rule-bound process, we come to the sort of absolute minimal threshold of necessary force. And that is what makes us morally superior. So it's both about the following of a rule and it's about the minimization. And I always find it extraordinary because, of course, you're right. Oftentimes the calculation is probabilistic. It's like there might be one terrorist. So if we do this and take them out and there are other casualties, it is collateral damage. It's not intentional, but it is entirely foreseeable. So what does it mean to say that we commit mayhem that is not intentional but entirely foreseeable? How does that make us somehow morally less culpable? And thinking about it from the other side, from the eyes of people who are the victims of American power, of course, there's no distinction. And therefore, when you turn around and try to look at American power through those eyes, what do you see? You don't see the operations of rule and the minimization of violence. You see the operations of a power that sees itself as able to act with impunity and to commit a kind of atrocity that has no sort of limitation to it, that is understandable within the terms of those who are on the other side of it or on the receiving end of it, right? So Trump comes in and basically says, you know, we're going to take the gloves off because this hasn't worked. And now we're going to sort of free the commanders in the field to sort of use maximum discretion. And we've already seen what's happening with that.
Discretion sounds like almost like they're being, I mean, I know what the word means, but it's, he's widened the rules of engagement so they can kill more civilians if they feel like it's necessary.
Yeah, basically, take the gloves off, do what you need to do, and don't worry so much about it.
Which is what he told the police chiefs in Suffolk County, Long Island. That's Jeremy Scahill's fairly long interview that's in the Intercepted podcast. He promised a longer one, and that one is an hour and 17 minutes long. The interviewee there is Professor Nikhil Pal Singh, some South Asian ethnicity there. He's at NYU, Social and Cultural Analysis in History. And his book that Jeremy read quickly, I guess, Race and America's Long War.